So last week, we were talking about the Boxer Rebellion in China that happened in 1900, that awful summer of 1900, where 189 Protestant missionaries were killed, 136 adults, 53 children. The China Inland Mission lost 58 missionaries and 21 children in that summer. And we focused especially on the 1,000 miles of miracle, the events in the life of Archibald and Flora Glover and their escape from Shanxi down to Wuhan in the midst of that terrible summer of rebellion and drought. I failed to mention last week at the end something I wanted to say about the godly leadership of D.E. Haast. If you remember, probably you don't, but a couple weeks ago when we talked about D.E. Haast, he became director of the mission the year after the Boxer Rebellion. And so you can imagine the difficult situation he was in. Hudson Taylor was still alive, but he was in his late 60s and he was in very poor health. In fact, he was convalescing in Switzerland in the summer of 1900. And his second wife, his first wife had died, his second wife was keeping from him all of the news from China, wasn't letting him read newspapers, wasn't reading letters to him, because she was afraid that all this news of this carnage would put him in his grave. Such was his heart for China and his heart for the missionaries. And so she was very selective about what she told him. And in the midst of all that, the heir apparent to Hudson Taylor, a man named William Cooper, was killed in the Boxer Rebellion. He was one of those ones that was massacred by the butcher of Shanxi when he lured all the missionaries into the capital and then beheaded them. And so D.E. Haast was selected, surprisingly, as a man in his 30s, to lead the mission. And Haast's first act was, what do we do? Because all the other missionary agencies were demanding reparations. They were going to the Chinese government and saying, here's our list of our losses, here's our lost property, here are the lives that were killed, and demanding restitution over this, justice. And D.E. Haast decided that was not the right course. He said, it will be well for missionaries to take a more Christ-like course, and even gladly to suffer the loss of all things that the gospel be not hindered. Our own mission has decided to make no claim whatever, either for life or property, and has assumed the responsibility of the orphan children of the martyred missionaries. And so they did not take accept any reparations from the Chinese government. They were the only mission agency that took that position in the aftermath of that terrible, terrible summer. Well, you see that James Frazier's dates correspond to the Boxer Rebellion. He was 14 when the Boxer Rebellion happened, and he's going to be in China in the first decade of the 20th century. And so let me just kind of throw everything up here as far as the dates, so you can kind of keep track of things as I go. James Frazier is one of my favorite characters in the annals of the China Inland Mission. He grew up in England in a broken home. His father and his mother were separated. They weren't divorced. You wouldn't do that in the 1880s. His parents were separated. He didn't know his father much at all. His mother was a godly lady who brought the kids into the Methodist Church in England. And as a teenager, James developed three aptitudes. First of all, physical endurance. He loved to run. He loved to mountain climb. He loved to cycle. His family was upper middle class, and they would take holiday in the summer in Switzerland. And he loved to mountain climb in Switzerland on holiday. He was very self-disciplined when it came to his endurance, physical endurance, and he once rode 199 miles without getting off his bike. And so that's quite a ways, 199 miles. I assume relatively flat terrain in England, but that's an accomplishment. I don't know why he didn't go the extra mile and go 200. Why get off your bike at 199, right? But I don't know, 199 was what he did. So he developed physical endurance, which is going to really play into his life as a missionary. He also developed a great love of music. He was a concert pianist, or at least on his way to becoming a concert pianist if he had stayed in Europe. He had committed all the great classics to memory. He was scheduled for a concert in London at the age of 20. He ended up canceling it because of his call to the mission field, but he was very good. A great lover of Chopin. And he had such a musical mind. And I can't imagine this. Maybe somebody like Wesley could imagine this. But when he was deprived of music in China for all those years, he had symphonic scores. And he would, as he's riding on his mule up to these different remote places he's visiting, he would read the symphonic score for the delight of the music. And he could hear the entire symphony in his head as he read the symphonic score. I don't see how that's possible, but that's what his granddaughter says in her biography. When he would convalesce in Shanghai, when he had different illnesses, he would always perform piano concerts weekly for the Europeans in Shanghai, and the people would come and flock to hear him. So he was a really gifted concert pianist and musician. And he was also, and these two things often go together, it seems, he was often a brilliant mathematician. He graduated from college with an engineering degree at the age of 20. And he had a great career ahead of him. He was really, really great at math. But in 1906, when he was 20 years old, he was handed a pamphlet from a friend, which talks about the Great Commission and the needs of the foreign fields and the multitudes that were dying without Christ. And he began to read the life of Hudson Taylor, and who was around his dying year at that point, right around the end of his life. And he heard C.T. Studd speak at one time, and he surrendered to the mission field at the age of 20. He applied to the China Inland Mission. He was rejected. The first two applications were rejected because he had an ear infection, and you had to be in really good physical health to be accepted by the CIM. But thankfully, in God's providence, that ear infection cleared up, and so on his third application, they accepted him after the physicians gave him the go-ahead. And so he arrived in China at the age of 21 in 1907. He went to work in a province, I'll show you a map just in a second here, called Yunnan, with a man named John McCarthy. John McCarthy was a great friend of Hudson Taylor, and John McCarthy was the one who wrote the letter to Hudson Taylor, and there was a sentence in the letter that changed Hudson Taylor's life. And we talked about Hudson Taylor's spiritual secret a couple weeks ago and the influence of Keswick on Taylor, and we talked about some of those difficulties. But Hudson Taylor did have this this experience that changed his life, and we talked about how it wasn't some sort of passivity sort of a thing. It was a real enduring thing, but just a life-changing experience. And it was a letter from John McCarthy that was the impetus to that, the catalyst for that. And so Frazier goes to work with McCarthy in the mountains of southwest China. And so here's a map of China. And so you've got Shanghai here and Hong Kong here, Taiwan. And Yunnan province is over here, on the border of Burma and Vietnam and, which is in Cambodia down here, right? You've got India over here. Okay, so right here on the borderlands, what they call them, is Yunnan. So he learned the language for the first couple of years. A quote about the language is that the Chinese language is a mountain. It's very steep at first, but gradually seems easier as you go up, and then, just when you feel you are getting on, another peak comes into view, rising higher than the first, but all a part of the same mountain. This also has to be climbed. This mountain is called Chinese thought and modes of expression. You had been told about it before you began to scramble up the first mountain, and the first glimpse shows how far it is above you. So he compares learning Chinese to a mountain climb, and it was appropriate that he would use that kind of imagery because Yunnan was a mountainous area. So here's a close-up of the Yunnan province, and James is going to spend his entire ministry on the border of Burma and China between the Mekong and Salween rivers here. And this is an extremely mountainous area. It really is the foothills to the Himalayas, which are over here. You know, Mount Everest would be like over here. You are in some high elevation. Everything's a mile high at least, if not, and sometimes it's above the snow line. And so here's some pictures of the territory that he's working in Yunnan. Okay, so that's a shot from Yunnan. And there's a valley in Yunnan with the Mekong River at the bottom. Some other shots of Yunnan. It is it's the most rugged and wild part of China. Well, he's living there in western China. Let me go back to western Yunnan. Whoops. There. He's living in this town right here, which is the only kind of city in this whole western area of the province. And while he's living there and he's learning the language, he begins to notice indigenous peoples coming down from the mountains to trade in the town. And he's very interested in them. You can tell they're poverty-stricken. You can tell they're very ignorant. But he really has a burden for these people. And he tries to befriend them. And he received an invitation to a wedding one day up in the mountains. And so he went up among these tribespeople. They live in scattered villages up here in the mountains and the valleys along these river basins here, right on the border of Burma, modern-day Myanmar. And he went up there at this invitation, and he began to try to learn their language. He couldn't talk to them at all. They didn't know Chinese. He didn't know their language. And so he's just sitting around listening, and he's jotting down their phrases. And so he would jot them down, and then he would repeat them back to him, back to these people. And the people were absolutely amazed. They called it his speaking paper, because they had never seen written language before. Written language was only verbal to them. And so to see language written down so that you can look at it and then say it was completely, completely foreign to them. And so they were amazed at his speaking paper and delighted at the way that he could repeat phrases to them. And Fraser soon learned that there were about 300 of these villages scattered around the mountain ranges, and about 10,000 people. It was an indigenous tribe called the Lisu tribe, and they had never had contact with Europeans. No European had ever been in these mountains before. He was the first one. He longed to work among them. He longed to learn their language and share the gospel with them. He longed for this, and he committed it to prayer. But the missionaries that he was working with in Tengchong, they were reassigned to another place. They were reassigned to the capital, Kunming. And that left James all alone over there in Tengchong. And so he was, had to hold down the mission station and do the preaching there to the Chinese people that were living in Tengchong, but all the while he has this burden. At one point, D.E. Haas was about to reassign Fraser to a new field, and Fraser was going to submit to it, but he was very disappointed in this and committed to prayer, and Haas surprisingly changed his mind and allowed Fraser to remain and sent another missionary couple to Tengchong to free up Fraser to go up into the mountains. And so he goes up into these mountains to find these Lisu people. And he settles among them. Let me kind of fast forward. I wanted to show you this picture. So he finds these villages scattered along the mountainside. This is a Lisu village in Yunnan. These little shanties with thatched roofs. There's another picture of them. And in 1914, he settled in among them. And he dressed like them. He ate their food. He conversed constantly with them to try to learn the language. He found his best helpers for the children. The children never tired of repeating phrases to him and of correcting his pronunciation. They would gather around him, and so he would repeat words and phrases to them until he had them down, and he wrote them all down. And for the next 8 years, James worked with these native people, the Lisu tribe. So there's James with some of his Lisu friends. God moved in answer to prayer, and in a two-year span, from 1914 to 1916, I think I gave the wrong date earlier, it was 1908 he went to go live among them. From 1914 to 1916 or so, James baptized 600 of these Lisu people. There was a great outpouring of God's Spirit, and James, like a lot of these early missionaries, was reluctant to baptize. This is not the sort of mass evangelism that you unfortunately see in the decisionism of our day. 600 real, proven converts in a two-year span. James's lasting impact is in two ways, in two areas of missionary work. The first is in missionary philosophy, and the second is in the matter of prayer. So when it comes to missionary philosophy, James Frazier was a couple generations ahead of his time in philosophy and thinking through work among indigenous tribes. He saw at the outset the need for these churches to be completely self-supporting. He diligently refused any foreign money whatsoever for these people. He would not pay them a cent for anything. He especially, when evangelists were sent out, they would receive no pay. Even the people that he would get to carry his stuff for him from village to village, he refused to pay them. They had to do it because they wanted to, not for money. These were going to be self-supporting churches from the start. He would also deliberately only spend a week or two in every village. There's 300 villages, and there's 10,000 people, and they're all scattered. And each village only has a few families in it. They're very small villages. And it would take days to get from one village to another village because of the terrain. You saw the terrain. And so he would deliberately only spend like 2 weeks at each village, and then he'd leave. And then he wouldn't see those people again for a year. So there was no way they could get dependent on him. There's no way that they could be dependent on the missionary from Europe. They had to learn to pray themselves. They had to learn to walk with God themselves. And so it was very unconventional for the early 20th century, late 19th century, but his methods have been proven true over the years. That is the best way of indigenous work, especially. To make it self-supporting from the get-go. And then his second contribution, great remembered, he's very much remembered for on the subject of prayer. He encountered early on the real spiritual warfare that ministry is. He saw it in a very raw form, working with indigenous tribes. He witnessed horrible demon worship in these villages. He talks about going to a festival one time called the Ladder Climbing Festival, where these different people be worked up into a frenzy, into a trance, and they would walk across hot coals and then climb a ladder made out of swords. And how the unfit would lose their lives. And this is no trick. This is not like, oh, it looks sharp, but maybe it's not. Right? I mean, the unfit, quote-unquote, they would... they would die. I mean, they would step on the ladder and their foot would be severed. They would fall back into the ashes and they'd burn to death. And nobody was willing to go save them because if the demons wanted them to die, I'm not going to intervene, right? But there would always be a couple that would make it. I mean, they would go through the fire and they would be completely unhurt by their feet. They would climb to the very top of the ladder and on the sharp swords, and they would give prophecies from up there, and they'd be completely unhurt. It was raw demonic power that he witnessed. And he saw demon possession, driving people insane, turning them into raving madmen. From time to time, when a family committed to Christ, there would be an inexplicable illness, often fatal, that would come into the family and frighten the family. One of the earliest families to turn to Christ up there in the mountains and destroy all of their idols. All four of their sons, one by one, died of a terrible suffering and disease, which, of course, the parents are just shaken. It's like, what have we done? We've made the demons mad. I mean, there was a great resistance from the forces of darkness as Frazier made this advance into millennia that had been held into a generation who had gone into this area that had been held by Satan for a millennia in his grip. And so that drove Frazier to his knees. He spent hours, sometimes entire days, begging God to deliver the Lisu from demon worship and from the powers of darkness, from the deceitful lies of Satan. Here are some of his quotes on prayer. He says, "I know enough about Satan to realize that he will have all his weapons ready for determined opposition. He would be a simpleton who expected plain sailing in any work of God. The aim of satanic power is to cut off communion with God. To accomplish this aim, he deludes the soul with a sense of defeat, covers him with a thick cloud of darkness, depresses and oppresses his spirit, which in turn hinders prayer and leads to unbelief, thus destroying all power. I used to think that prayer should have the first place and teaching the second. I now feel that it would be truer to give prayer the first, second, and third place and teaching the fourth. Solid, lasting missionary work is done on our knees. I do not intend to be one of those who bemoan little results while resting in the faithfulness of God. My cue is to take hold of the faithfulness of God and use the means necessary to secure big results." And that means, of course, being prayer. Much of what we know about Frazier comes from letters to his mother. He asked his mother in a really low state in his work among the Lisu, this first several years where nothing was happening. He asked his mother to gather together a group of friends that would faithfully pray for him once a day. His mother found 8 other ladies to do this, and so there was this prayer circle in England. And he would write to his mother and write to these ladies individually, telling them every detail about his work, so that they could pray with detail about the work that he was in. He writes to them and he says, "I'm not asking you to just give help in prayer as a sort of sideline. I am trying to roll the main responsibility of this prayer warfare over to you. I want you to take the burden of these people upon your shoulders and to wrestle with God for them." He says, he's 33 when he writes this, "I cannot insist too strongly on my own helplessness among these people apart from the grace of God. I have been now 10 years in China. I have considerable experience with Chinese and Lisu, but I find myself able to do little or nothing apart from God's going before me and working among them. Without the work of God, I feel like a man who has his boat grounded in shallow water. Push or pull as he may, he will not be able to move his boat more than a few inches. But let the tide come in and lift his boat off the bottom, and then he'll be able to move it as far as he pleases, quite easily and without friction. It is indeed necessary for me to go around among our Lisu, preaching, teaching, exhorting, rebuking, but the amount of progress made thereby depends almost entirely on the state of spiritual tide in the village. And you in England have just as much control over that as I do by your prayers. And so pray that the tide will come in these villages so that we're not just grounded in shallow water. And so James worked for 15 years in China among these people without taking a furlough at all during those 15 years. And it's just a real legacy of work. I've got to bring this to a close here. I've got several other things to talk about, but it was good that Fraser took that line of self-supporting churches, because it wasn't long after his death that the communist uprising happened in China, forcing all missionaries to leave, and these people were left all by themselves for the next two generations. And between 1950 and 1980, there wasn't a single contact with them because of the veil coming over China in those early years of Mao's reign over there. In 1980, there was established reconnection with the Lisu people, and there was a thriving church that was still found among them to this day. If you look up statistics, you find these people and the dominant religion being Christianity in these mountain people up in Yunnan province on the border of Burma. And so I've got two biographies of James Fraser. I gave one away with our first book giveaway, so some of you have that, called Behind the Ranges. There's another biography written by his granddaughter that is called, Mountain Rain. And that's a little fuller, more full biography. If you read the Behind the Ranges biography, you know that Geraldine Taylor had a stroke halfway through writing that biography, so she wasn't able to finish it. So all you get is his life up till the Lisu revival, and then it kind of cuts off kind of suddenly. And so it ends abruptly because Geraldine had a stroke. So if you want the full life of Fraser, Mountain Rain is the biography. Both of them are in the library over there. All right, thank you for your attention, and let's prepare now for our prayer time.